Welcome to New World Notes. I am Kenneth Doust. Today we'll hear the second and final part of a great talk that Bruce Gagnon gave near Hartford on August 20th. Bruce is a longtime activist for peace, against nuclear weapons, and particularly against sending nukes into space. As he sees it, our whole system is now serving the military-industrial complex. And the military-industrial complex is serving only the transnational capitalist oligarchs. It's a disturbing view, but Bruce backs it up by quoting extensively from the Pentagon itself. One quick footnote, when Bruce refers to vision, he's referring specifically to a document titled Vision 2020. This was published by a military service called the U.S. Space Command. In it, they describe their plans to control not only the world, but the solar system as well. And they're quite candid about for whose benefit they are doing this. Hint, it's not we the people. Here's Bruce Gagnon.
And so that's kind of what it feels like to me in America today. Increasingly, we have the lords and masters running the Congress to the benefit of the corporate elite, the oligarchy, and the people in our little thatched hut villages, if you will. Our job is to serve their interests, which means, in this case, fight their wars so that they can extract declining resources around the world to the benefit of the corporations. So, as I like to say, we're basically behind the eight ball. How do we get out from behind the eight ball? First of all, I think you've probably seen it in Connecticut. We've seen it in Maine. I've seen it across the country as I travel. That since the election of Barack Obama, the air went out of the balloon of the peace movement. I believe to a considerable extent, Obama was elected because people were tired of the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. And a lot of that energy, he rode, like he jumped on a horse and rode it into the White House victoriously, got off his horse, took it to the barn, put the horse in the barn, and put a titanium padlock on the door. And ever since then, he's joined the forces of the oligarchy. Now, not that I ever thought that he was going to be a noble knight, because before the election, I have a dear friend, an old man in Maine, a guy by the name of Herschel, who one night asked me if I'd ever heard of the Crown family. I said, no, I never have. He said, well, go home and Google them, Crown family, Chicago. So I did. And come to find out, the Crown family in Chicago were the largest stockholders in General Dynamics Corporation. And early on, this Jewish family went out across America when Barack Obama was an unknown and promoted him within the national Jewish community for president of the United States, raised massive amounts of money, and helped get him elected. And so it's no coincidence today that where I live in Bath, Maine, there's a weapons corporation there owned by General Dynamics, a company called Bath Iron Works, where they're building the Aegis destroyers that are now being ported all over the world, being used to surround Russia and China. On board these Aegis destroyers are what are called missile defense systems, or as we like to call them, missile offense systems. Now, when Bush was in power, he had a different missile defense program. He was going to deploy some other missile defense, quote-unquote missile defense systems, in Poland and the Czech Republic. And when Obama came into office, he pulled those deployments back, and he said, instead, we're going to use these Aegis destroyers outfitted with missile defense systems, which means that General Dynamics has to build more of them. And in fact, they were costing $1.5 billion each. And now they've come up with a new version that is going to cost $3 billion each. Called the DDG-1000. And so Obama, as I see it, is rewarding the people that put him into power. And in fact, we know that Obama got more money, more campaign donations from the military-industrial complex than John McCain, the war hawk, did in the last election. So it was obvious to anybody that was really paying any attention that, as many people have said, Obama's campaign was really a public relations campaign. But as I started to say earlier, since his election, we've seen the fragmentation and the disillusion of the peace movement across America as massive numbers of quote-unquote liberals have left the peace movement, stopped donating to it, stopped actively participating in it, because they did not want to be critical of Barack Obama and the Democratic Party, who not only were in charge of the White House, but they were in charge of the Senate and the House of Representatives as well until the last midterm election. And so we've seen then under the Democrat rule, if you will, an escalation on every level of corporatism and of militarism. What Mussolini called fascism, the wedding of corporatism and militarism. So how do we get out from behind this eight ball? Especially when our groups, our membership, our forces are decimated by people that don't want to stand up to the Democratic Party. How do we get around it? Well, we do have a problem on this earth today, I believe, and it's not Al-Qaeda. It's not Gaddafi. It is, in fact, climate change. Just on the way here today, driving here, I was listening to NPR, a story about the melting of the Arctic. So severe that they think in just a couple years, they're going to be having tremendous amount of shipping and sea lanes through the Arctic. And they now say that they believe that there's massive oil underneath the ice of the Arctic. And so the United States and Russia are now coming into conflict over who has access to that. And the U.S. is rallying its forces in Norway and other countries that live along the Arctic regions against Russia. Russia, by the way, has the world's largest supply of natural gas and significant supplies of oil. And we believe this is the reason why the United States today, NATO and the United States today, are beginning a military encirclement or continuing a military encirclement of Russia. China imports 80% of its oil on ships through what's called the Yellow Sea. And it's no coincidence that today the U.S. is doubling its military presence in that Asian Pacific region as part of a strategy to be able to choke off China's importation of oil. So as we face climate change, as we face the diminishment of fossil fuels and other declining resources around the world, the U.S. military strategy is thus. We will increase our militarism globally in order to control the access to declining resources. We might not be able to compete with China economically, but if we control their access to oil by being able to choke off their importation of oil on ships, then we will hold the keys to their economic engine. So this is the U.S. strategy today. This is the Obama strategy. This is the Pentagon strategy. And this is the General Dynamics strategy that says massively build these ships, use them to surround China and Russia. And that's what's happening today. University of Massachusetts Economics Department did a study in 2007 where they looked at $1 billion of military spending. How many jobs do they create per $1 billion? You know, everybody's talking about jobs these days. Every politician, local, state, national, everybody's talking about jobs. Globally, they're talking about jobs. And it's funny, you never hear about this study. UMass Amherst said, yes, it's true. You spend $1 billion on military production, you create 8,555 jobs. 8,555. But, they said, you take that same $1 billion, you put it into healthcare, you create 12,883 jobs. You put it into education, you create 17,687 jobs. You build mass transit systems, close down the military-industrial complex, stop making Aegis destroyers, stop making warplanes, stop making drones, stop making guns, make trains, help get us out of our gas-guzzling cars. You take that same $1 billion and you build rail systems, you create 19,795 jobs. So what we've been doing in Maine is asking people this very question. You say you're job scared, you're job worried, you're job concerned. Which would you rather have? 8,555 jobs building weapons for endless war, or 19,795 jobs building rail systems, connecting every corner of the state of Maine? Years ago, they used to have trains that ran all over Maine. You could go anywhere in Maine on a train. Today, you can't go anywhere in Maine on a train. You have to have a car. And people can't afford to put gas in them anymore. And so people, when they hear these numbers, I've yet to hear anyone say, yes, we want only 8,555 jobs. The other thing we have to do is we have to talk to the local politicians. I know you all went to your city council in Hartford and got them to join some other communities that have passed Bring Our War Dollars Home resolutions. And we congratulate you for being involved in that effort. In Maine, we went to our first successful one was to go to a little tiny school board up in northern Maine where there are no jobs other than people working in the woods, convenience stores, and a little bit of a very tiny school board in the town of Solon, Maine. And the Solon school board passed the first Bring Our War Dollars Home resolution. The Deer Isle Town Meeting passed one. Then the Portland City Council passed a resolution as well. Amherst and Northampton, Massachusetts passed one. And then you all followed them, I understand. And then the U.S. Conference of Mayors, just a month or so ago, passed a resolution at their national conference in Baltimore. The first time they stepped into a foreign policy issue since around 1970 during the Vietnam War. And immediately following their resolution, Los Angeles, California, and Eugene, Oregon also passed resolutions. Now, why is Bring Our War Dollars Home the right strategy for this moment? Because we need to get local elected officials to begin to speak out against endless war spending. If we have any hope of turning the national government around on this issue. Local elected officials historically say, it's not my bailiwick. It's not our job to talk about foreign policy. We're not supposed to do that. But what we need to be saying to local officials is, and in fact, it is your responsibility, because when you take the oath of office, you swear that you will protect the people, that you will protect the interests of the people, that you will stand up and fight for the people. And we know that there cannot be social progress in America. There cannot be public education in America. There cannot be health care. There cannot be a sound infrastructure. We can't fix our roads and bridges. We can't have public transportation. We can't have sewer and water systems that function properly unless local governments have resources. And there will not be local resources for these governments in this new direction of security export and endless war. It ain't going to happen. It's one or the other. Two trains on a collision course, one called Endless War, Vision for 2020, and the other called Social Progress in America. There's going to be a collision. One of them is not going to survive. I tell people all the time, don't fear this vision, because like everything else and everyone else, it has an Achilles heel. And its Achilles heel is the big green, money. We can stop it, but we have to fight for social progress. And we have to name this. We have to get the public to understand that this is the enemy and that this is not a vision for the future generation's survival. This is a prescription for planetary death. And so we have to put out an alternative, transformative vision of the future that calls for conversion of the military-industrial complex, that fully supports social progress in our nation. And in that process, enlivens any hope for a real democracy, which we do not have today in the United States of America. So as far as I'm concerned, that's where we need to go. In a way, it's simple, and to me it's clear, but it's extremely difficult. It's a hard row to hoe. It's going to require a lot of work. And going up against the biggest, wealthiest interest that we've ever faced in the history of this nation and probably the history of the world. But I'd just like to close by asking people this question. What else could be more important in our life? What does it mean to be a human being on the earth? To have the best car, to have the best house, to have the fanciest title on your business card, or to protect the future generations, to protect the Mother Earth and all of our relatives that live on this planet, the things that swim, the things that fly, the things that crawl, the four-leggeds, the two-leggeds. Let me close with this poem by Lakota activist John Trudell. It's called Crazy Horse. Crazy Horse, we hear what you say. One earth, one mother. One does not sell the earth that people walk upon. We are the land. How do we sell our mother? How do we sell the stars? How do we sell the air? Crazy Horse, we hear what you say. Too many people standing their ground, standing the wrong ground. Predator's face, he possessed a race. Possession, a war that doesn't end. Children of God feed on children of earth. Days people don't care for people. These days are the hardest. Material fields, material harvest. Decoration on chains that binds. Mirrors gold. The people lose their minds. Crazy Horse, we hear what you say. One earth, one mother. One does not sell the earth the people walk upon. We are the land. Today is now and then. Dream smokes touch the clouds. On a day when death didn't die, real world time tricks shadows lie. Red white perception deception. Predator tries civilizing us, but the tribes will not go without return. Genetic light from the other side. Crazy Horse, we hear what you say. Thank you all very much.
Some questions followed, and some of Bruce's responses were especially interesting. In this one, he talks about the Pentagon's plan to control not only Earth but the solar system, about the corporate oligarchs' plan to mine other planets, and, courtesy of the Pentagon's missiles, to prevent all others from doing so. To succeed, they will have to power their spacecrafts by plutonium. Disaster in the making. Sound like science fiction? Bruce quotes the Pentagon itself, specifically the document called Vision 2020, published by the U.S. Space Command.
Remember in here one of the things they talked about is under historical perspective. Likewise, space forces will emerge to protect military and commercial national interests and investments in the space medium due to their increasing importance. What is the space medium? And what interests and investments are they talking about in the space medium? You know, they say that in order to continue our consumptive way of life on Earth, we need six more planets to give us the resources to keep our, you know, industrial planet going. And they say, basically, don't worry about it. We've identified them. Halliburton, you know who Halliburton is, right? Well, I read in one in the Petroleum News newsletter a couple years ago that Halliburton was working on the drilling mechanism to mine Mars. They say there's helium-3 on the moon that could be used for fusion power on Earth to make the profits of the oil corporations look like nothing in comparison. Magnesium and cobalt and uranium on Mars, they say. Asteroids with gold. All right, so the idea, and they've been working on this since the 1950s, is to go out and literally mine the sky. Develop the technologies, NASA's job, develop the technologies to create launch capabilities so it's cost-effective to go mine the sky. And when that day comes, privatize. And you see, one of the first things Obama did when he came into office was to begin privatizing NASA. It's now 85% privatized. They're privatizing launch capability because it's becoming, you know, easier to do. And Elon Musk from PayPal is now developing launch systems and all this kind of stuff. So anyway, the bottom line is they want to go out and colonize the way they did the Indian lands and everything else. They want to go colonize the planets. And they want to build a parallel military highway between the Earth and the planetary bodies so that we will control who can get on and off the planet Earth to go out and make the profits in the future. All right. There was a study done, commissioned by the Congress of the United States, signed by the likes of Senator John Glenn at the time, Representative Bill Nelson, who is now Senator Bill Nelson from Florida, went up on the space shuttle one time. He signed this thing. It was called Military Space Forces the Next 50 Years. And in there they said, with armed forces on the moon and on space stations on either side, we would be able to control who got on and off the planet Earth. And we'd be able to hijack rival shipments upon return. If anyone else tried to go out and mine the sky and they were not authorized, we could take them out. So it's corporate globalization run amok. So that's the vision they're working on, too. Not only control the Earth to the benefit of the of corporate globalization, but also now space. Plutonium, nuclear power in space, becomes a key ingredient to make this whole thing happen. How are you going to power massive rocket capability to be able to launch these kind of heavy payloads to go and mine and go back and forth? How are you going to get to Mars? It takes a year to get to Mars with conventional rockets, but the human body deteriorates because of space radiation, so you have to get there in half the time. Well, with a nuclear reactor on board a rocket, you get there in half the time, they say. So nuclear industry views space as a new market, and so they're pushing the development of nuclear energy for space technology. The problem is when you launch a host of nuclear missions on rockets that have 10% failure rate, sooner or later, one of the bullets in the chamber goes off. 1964, U.S. military satellite called SNAP-9A with 2 pounds of plutonium on board fell back to Earth, burned up on reentry. Plutonium was burned up and spread as dust particles across the planet to be inhaled by the people of the Earth into our lungs. Dr. John Goffman, one of the founders of uranium, studied that accident, believes it's one of the major contributors to the epidemic of cancers around the Earth today. 1997, they launched Cassini with 72 pounds of plutonium on board. We ran a campaign all over the world against it. This coming November, December is a month-long launch window. They're going to launch a Mars rover, 10.6 pounds of plutonium on board. In their environmental impact statement, NASA says, if there was a launch pad explosion, plutonium was broken into dust particles. The winds could carry it for a 60-mile radius in central Florida, from the Space Center out to Disney World on the west, north to Daytona Beach and south to Vero Beach, Florida. And they'd have to go in and remove all the people. They'd have to go in and remove all the buildings. They'd have to go in and remove all the vegetation. They'd have to go in and remove all the animals, the birds, the fish, the snakes, the alligators, the squirrels. Can you imagine? And then they'd have to go in and remove that top half inch of soil, because everything would be radioactive for thousands and thousands of years. Can you imagine Hurricane Katrina disaster on steroids? It's insanity.
One audience member talked of how psychologically hard it is to criticize the oligarchy, endless militarism, and particularly President Obama. Her fellow progressives just don't want to hear it, don't want to critique the system, don't want to acknowledge that Obama is not a knight on a white horse, but rather George Bush III. Bruce's long reply included a sketch of a friend of his who fits this description to a T.
I still have a friend who's a brilliant guy in Maine. His grandfather was the governor of New York at one time, years back. This guy is smart as hell. He went to Harvard. He was a Vietnam veteran. He's a very close friend of mine. He still maintains to this day, when we talk about Obama, that Obama has a secret plan, and after he wins election, he's going to spring it on the nation and turn it all around. And he's not kidding, because he truly wants to believe. He wants to believe. Okay? And I've come to the conclusion that the reason why my friend believes this way is because he doesn't really want to fight. He really doesn't. And what I mean by that, not like get out in a fist fight in the middle of the street, but I'm talking about he doesn't really want to go up against the oligarchy. Because as long as my friend can maintain this illusion in his mind that somehow this thing's going to turn around and somehow Obama's going to, I call him Obama the magician, you see. Because he has this incredible sleight of hand capability where he can show one thing to one and one to the other and fool people. And he's got my friend backed up against the wall, you know, in awe of his magic show. And the reason is my friend doesn't want to take it on in his heart of hearts. He doesn't have it in him. He's still sold on the system that it can work, that it will work. And that's his hope. That's what hope means to him, that the system can be reformed. The system can be changed. And that, I think, is the pill that many, many people in America still swallow, still take religiously every morning with their vitamins and their antidepressants.
That's all there is. There ain't no more. I recorded Bruce Gagnon in Wethersfield, Connecticut on August 20th. To learn more about Bruce's work, check out www.spaceforpeace.org. That's numeral 4, spaceforpeace.org. For more on New World Notes, including an archive of past installments, check out newworldnotes.blogspot.com. On behalf of the entire staff of New World Notes, this is Kenneth Doust advising illegit to my non-carborundum. Thanks for listening, and please tune in again.